You're listening to Pep Talk, discussing policy, evidence and practice in Wales. Pep Talk is brought to you by the Wales Centre for Public Policy at Cardiff University. This episode was recorded prior to the reintroduction of stricter lockdown measures on the 22nd of September 2020.
Hello and welcome to Pep Talk. Loneliness is something that affects lots or even all of us at different points in our lives. And the coronavirus pandemic and social distancing measures have had various impacts on our lives and may mean that more of us have been experiencing loneliness or social isolation. We've been doing some work at the centre on loneliness and the implications of the coronavirus pandemic for conventional approaches to tackling it. Existing services may have had to adapt and new services have been set up during lockdown. It's important that services have effective means of communicating with their intended service users, and that where services have been set up to tackle social isolation, these enable communications between people that meaningfully mitigate feelings of loneliness. Communicating complex and changing messages is a challenge, and it's important to get right communicating about safely making changes to our economic and social behaviours through different phases of the pandemic. I'm your host, Laura Bennett, and with me today are two experts who offer insight into loneliness and communication. My first guest is Robin Hewings, Director of Campaigns, Policy and Research from the Campaign to End Loneliness. Robin, can you tell us a little about the Campaign to End Loneliness?
Yes, so we do a few different things. We help to bring to life research about loneliness and recently published a report about the psychology of loneliness. We also work with the community of organisations who help to alleviate loneliness, often small local voluntary organisations, but also larger ones as well. And finally, we make the case that loneliness is an important issue that needs to be tackled by decision makers as well as wider society. And as a little kind of microcosm of that, we've been doing some focused work in West Wales over the last few years.
Also joining us today is Claire Delaghi, Principal Advisor from the UK Behavioural Insights team. Claire, what do you do at the Behavioural Insights team?
The Behavioural Insights team was set up in 2010 in the Cabinet Office, but has since spun out as a social purpose company. And we focus on two main things. So the first of which is designing policies and services and communications that go with the grain of human behaviour. So using academic research about how people actually behave rather than how we might think or want people to behave, and making sure that we design systems that work for them. And the second pillar of our work is to rigorously evaluate everything that we do, so as much as possible. So we know that it's very hard to predict human behavior, and an intervention that might seem very common sense and like it would definitely work and help people, oftentimes when we evaluate them, we find that it isn't as effective as we might have wanted. So we primarily run what are called randomized controlled trials to test the interventions that we design.
Thank you both for joining us today. Let's begin with some context. We know that loneliness is something that many people will experience at some point in their life, and social distancing measures have meant that most of us are experiencing some impact on our social connections and interactions. Robin, what has been the impact of the pandemic on the experience of loneliness, and what will be some of the priorities as things change?
We've had quite a bit of data about the impact of the pandemic on loneliness. So there's a study based at UCL that has found essentially that the people who are already lonely have got lonelier, and people who weren't already lonely have got less lonely. And I think that's because people who already had good relationships, particularly the closest relationships, have been spending more time with their family. They're not traveling to go to work and so on. But people who already had a lot of the risk factors, such as living alone or being bereaved, the impact of lockdown has only made that worse. So I think that's a really kind of sad and striking finding. The other thing that the Office for National Statistics found was that there's a kind of a standard question that you ask people about loneliness, which is, are you always or often lonely? And they found that the people saying yes to that didn't really change. But when they asked the general population, has lockdown affected your well-being, people who said that it had, what they cited was one of the biggest driver of that was loneliness. And so I think that what tells us is that people, that the lack of connection that people was having was very much impacting on people's well-being. But they were recognising that this was a temporary state. This was data that was taken in kind of April, May time. And I think finally, I think we've just seen some very striking individual stories about the way that the pandemic has made it much harder for people to have their normal social life. And so, for example, there was a very striking case study on ITV Wales with our partner host organisation Independent Age, with someone who had very significant sight loss. And so the way in which she could leave the house was if someone came and held her by the arm. And so that had to stop. And so she hasn't left the house. She still sees her daughter, but she can't see the kind of she receives a kind of befriending service. And that hasn't been anything like what it's been normally been. And I think it's really, really, that kind of loss has really affected her. And I think that another kind of way in which the pandemic, and this kind of relates to loneliness in a couple of ways, is one of them is that people have had less news and they've had less to talk about. And I think that has been a real issue. And I think kind of boredom has also been a real effect of this period. And also I think that what we get out of our relationships is the fun and interest of it. But it's also, we also use our relationships and talking as a way of processing difficult situations. And it's how we kind of relieve stress and relieve worry. And so the way in which we haven't been able to have our relationships as much, I think has made it harder for us to manage the really great stresses that we've had over the last 6 months.
Yeah, I think we can all recognise the different ways that the pandemic has affected lots of the things that we normally do, whether that's meeting up with family and friends, seeing colleagues at work, taking part in community activities. And you touched on there the impact on the befriending service. And indeed, I guess almost all services that exist to support people and help people to meet up and interact socially have been unable to operate in their usual ways. How have existing and new services for loneliness and social isolation been redesigned to enable meaningful interactions?
I'm tempted to say, how long have you got? Actually, I think that as a sector, we've seen a really extraordinary kind of dynamism and sense of mission. I think people kind of recognised really quickly the seriousness of lockdown for loneliness, and people have done all kinds of things. We've run a series of webinars with organisations who work on loneliness about what they're doing. People moved a lot online, so kind of classically people were doing, moved choirs to online choirs or exercise sessions of them. People have moved over to Zoom, and I think people would say that you know, it's not the same, but it's really helped. But also people providing those services have been very conscious of digital exclusion and the different forms that takes, that it isn't a binary divide, the digital divide, that it goes from people who have got home broadband and smartphones and everything else through to people who don't have broadband but do have a phone but not much data, through to people who have got a kind of a phone that they use as a mobile but not very much else, through to people who don't use, about 5 or 6 million people who don't use the internet at all. So, and people have been doing different things to take account of that divide, and that can be about doing things in person, such as socially distant, knocking on people's doors and talking to them in that way, or through the window. All kinds of really inventive activity packs, such as things to just kind of alleviate the boredom so that people have got something else to think about, but also so that people have got things to do and then to talk to other people about, such as kind of seeds and things to grow. And finally, using the phone, that almost everyone does have access to the phone, and so people have been doing kind of using the telephone for befriending, and we've been running a campaign just to encourage people to ring people up who they might generally see or might have just kind of rekindled old relationships. And then as we're kind of in this kind of funny re-emergence stage, people are kind of moving towards doing things like socially distanced walks so that people can meet up and get outside and see other people, but you're doing it in a way that feels like it's reasonably safe. But I have to say, the organisations doing that, having to work through a really complex set of safeguarding and kind of risk management issues, which make that process something that puts a great deal of responsibility on people running services.
You've touched on some of the challenges facing services there, and one of the other big challenges is the things that prevent people from engaging with services. So I wondered if you could tell us a bit about kind of what we know about the things that prevent people from engaging with services for loneliness.
So there is a stigma to loneliness, and people feel reluctant to admit to themselves that they're lonely, and certainly to tell others. And so I think it's important that this will be a long, slow process, but I think it's important that we act to kind of reduce it and talk about it. And I think that's why we support the government's Let's Talk Loneliness campaign in England. And I think that kind of movement to recognise that loneliness is a really common emotion that almost everyone will experience at some point in their lives. And I think that we're always looking for silver linings at the moment. And I think one is that I think lockdown has made it a bit more easy to talk about loneliness. And I think that we've seen some of the value of having the kind of government strategies and so on, is that it does, those in themselves help to normalise the idea that this is common and important. I think that for services, I think that not identifying as loneliness does make it harder to focus, and finding people is not easy. But I think that probably the most important thing, and this comes out of the report we did recently on the psychology of loneliness, is that the real danger of loneliness is not that it's a kind of fleeting emotion that you can then do something about and then it's fine. It's the when it becomes dangerous is when it goes into a kind of a downward spiral, where when people become lonely, they think about their social interactions in a more negative ways. So for example, everyone all the time commits slight faux pas and then gets over it and stops thinking about it, whereas I think for lonely people they can think about it a lot more. They can think about if someone has slightly slighted them, it kind of, people then start withdrawing even more, and it can be difficult for people to get back into social life. And so I think that for services, I think it's really important that whatever that they're doing, that they think quite consciously about the psychology of loneliness and how the people they're trying to engage may well be in that downward spiral and will need, at the very least, real kind of welcome and encouragement into, say, you're running a group of some kind. And obviously people don't go to loneliness clubs, they go to clubs that they enjoy. But so whatever it is, whether it's knitting or woodwork or choirs or books, that you make sure that you're running a group that feels like an inclusive and respectful place to newcomers as well as to people who've been going for a long time.
Claire, how can public services better reach people who would benefit from services?
One way of evaluating this kind of a service might be to compare the people who have signed up for the befriending service and measure their loneliness at the start and at the end of receiving the service compared to people who didn't sign up for the service. But I think, as you may be able to tell, there's probably one big flaw in that, and I think Robin has alluded to that already, is that people who might feel able to kind of sign up and participate in things are probably quite different from the people who actually, you know, can't do that or find it very difficult to do. So in order to truly measure the impact of a particular service or intervention that we might design, we need to try and remove those differences between groups. And that's essentially what a randomized controlled trial does. So in the context of a befriending service, it would randomly allocate people to be offered the chance to sign up for the service compared to some people who aren't, and then measure the impact of that service on their loneliness. And I think that's important to say, because when we're thinking about how we might better reach people across different services and processes, there's lots of kind of stages of a research process. So the first is probably to think about what specific behaviors are we talking about? Are we looking at people signing up for a befriending service, or going on walks, or accessing community activities? And what do we know about where people sort of fall off in that process? So is it that people don't know what's available in an area. So even if they wanted to go on a community walk, they just don't know that it exists. Is it that they know it exists, but they're, you know, nervous or worried about going? Or is it that they are very interested in going and intend to go every Saturday, but really just the sign up process maybe is a bit difficult? Or like a lot of us, people struggle to sort of convert their intentions into action. So I intend next week to eat very healthily and, you know, to go for lots of walks and runs. But in reality, probably next week, I'll do what I did this week, which is have a chocolate bar after work every day. So in trying to understand what specific behaviors we're talking about and what is the experience of people who might be coming into contact with these services, then we can think about sort of a whole host of interventions that might help to improve reach. So those might be improving outreach to specific groups or types of people that we think would benefit, simplifying our processes, looking at ways that we might be able to create a more welcoming environment for newcomers. And then we've essentially got a bundle of lots of different types of interventions that we think could plausibly improve the reach of our service. And what's important is not just do any of these things work, but do any of them work more than others? So one might increase the reach of our service by, you know, it increases the number of people attending by 3 percentage points, but actually we might find that some other type of intervention increases the reach by 5 percentage points, in which case, from a policy perspective, we might be more interested in the intervention that is more likely to increase our reach. And that's quite a simplified version, an example. But I think sort of thinking about very sort of forensically targeting what aspects of processes we're looking at and then rigorously testing different kinds of interventions to see which ones can be more effective.
I'm just wondering if there are common things in terms of what services get wrong in their communicating and reaching people who would benefit from their services.
I'd hesitate to say wrong because I think I agree with Robin about the vast amount of effort and work that people have put in to sort of transform services, move things from completely offline to completely online, and how difficult that probably has been for people. So I think it's more about, you know, now that lots of organizations have sort of done a lot of that heavy lifting to shifting their sort of services and offer, and now that it looks like we're going to have to restrict our social activities or change the way that we interact with others for a longer period of time, are there other things that we can sort of test and experiment with to help people sort of to continue to participate? Things that I would be particularly interested in testing in terms of how do we create, I think, meaningful interactions, which you mentioned earlier, are a couple of things in terms of social connections. So the first of which would be how we frame who is the helper and who is being helped, and do we actually need to frame things like that? So when the pandemic hit and we had a lot of people who were shielding at home and perhaps were already vulnerable or newly kind of had to consider themselves as vulnerable because of underlying medical conditions or something like that they might have, they were on the receiving end of help from lots of different organizations and government, but that doesn't mean that they couldn't also offer help in the sense of being able to sort of provide social connections for other people. So when we're sort of thinking about befriending services and other social connections, given that we know there's kind of a stigma to loneliness, how do we sort of convey to people who are participating in these services that they can come and help others to have positive experiences? And it doesn't sort of have to be that this kind of, there's one person who's volunteering and there's one person who's not volunteering, and it's kind of that, in that kind of a binary. The second then would be sort of thinking about the guardrails that we can put around conversations that allow people sort of to have a route of escape in the back of their mind if they really need to kind of have it. And so the example that I think of here is that, I mean, who knows when many of us will be on a plane again, but when you sit beside someone for a long plane ride, I've often been sort of worried to start up a conversation with someone because I essentially don't have an exit for the duration of the plane ride. So can we sort of, if people are sort of worried to start conversations because if it doesn't go very well or they don't really have much to say, they kind of don't know how to escape from that particular conversation, can we sort of set up conversations as, okay, start with a quick 10-minute conversation, and obviously it can continue then if people are enjoying themselves, but it's sort of easy for people to stop there and they kind of have permission to do so. And the final thing that I would say is is sort of thinking about different types of social interactions and what they can actually do for us. And Robin mentioned earlier that for a lot of people, the pandemic might have been a time at which we have strengthened what are often referred to as our strong ties. So the people from our sort of close friends and family network who we might have stayed in touch with more, had weekly quizzes with, or all that kind of thing. But often it's been our weak ties that have been sort of harder to maintain during this period. So maybe saying hello to someone down at a local shop, or speaking to somebody on the bus. And if someone has sort of maintained strong ties, or has, you know, family members who visit them, can we sort of help people to see from a stigma perspective that their weak ties are also very important? And so seeking sort of a befriending service is not a reflection on your strong ties, or whether, you know, have close friends and family or not. There are different sort of aspects of our social life that fulfill different needs for us.
So most of our existing approaches to reducing loneliness and social isolation rely very much on face-to-face contact. And we know that technology is not an adequate replacement for face-to-face contact. So I guess they're kind of different types of interactions and different types, you know, weak versus strong social ties and the different kind of interactions you might have. So because of social distancing, services have had to come up with interventions that don't rely exclusively on that face-to-face contact. So I'm wondering what we know about how people have experienced the transition of services from face-to-face to virtual.
So I think that, to be honest, some people haven't experienced the transition because they're digitally excluded, but we have seen some work to reduce that. So, for example, devices.now have worked with a number of public and private sector organisations to get devices to some of the people that need them most, which is, I think, a really important thing to do and will have kind of longer term benefits. And we've even seen in some areas people getting dongles and data so that people can engage in some ways. Obviously, if it's particularly important, is engaging with school and learning, but it is also can be fantastically helpful to be able to just kind of video call someone. That can feel like a more of a connection than otherwise. I think, as you say, it's not as good in some ways. There are ways in which you can talk over each other, you can chat in person, that just does feel more meaningful. And there's even some slightly artificial evidence that touch is relevant to loneliness as well, and that people don't experience touch, that over time that can really feel like particularly relevant to the kind of bit of loneliness that relates to feeling kind of cared for. And I think one can well imagine why that would be. But what it can do is it can increase reach. So I was talking, for example, to someone from the MS Society, and they were running sessions in Essex, where they are particularly based, and those were in-person exercise sessions, and people would come, and it was, you know, and it was good. But during lockdown they went online, and they found that their reach could increase to other people who wouldn't normally be able to engage with them. And so I think that what I hope we will do is to be able to find ways of blending approaches. So what have we learnt, and how have we engaged, and how have we reached more people who wouldn't have been able to make it for just it's too far away, or people who might have kind of struggled to get there, because obviously disability is a really big driver of loneliness. And how can we kind of blend these two approaches and have ways of bringing people together online that we weren't before? And how will we make sure that people can still find ways of meeting face to face?
Yeah, and hopefully, as you know, restrictions are changed and eased in different ways, we can make use of those face to face and technology enabled interventions and approaches. So we've touched on some kind of principles that can be applied to interventions to enable meaningful interactions, but I wonder if there are ones that are particularly relevant for virtual services. So kind of once people are sort of through the door, what principles are most important to ensure that those interventions enable meaningful interactions?
So yeah, I think principles for virtual services, as Robin has kind of outlined, is how easy and simple is it for people to access these things? And then are there sort of aspects of the conversation that we can over time sort of try to replicate or approximate real world conversations in the way that Robin mentioned, sort of people talking each other in the pub, or sort of the ability for people to meet new people. Like I know that Zoom has a breakout room function where you can sort of assign people into smaller groups to allow them to sort of meet other people and talk to those. So I think it's going to be probably a lot of creative thinking over the next while in terms of how can we sort of help people to build and sort of maintain weak ties over the next while, and sort of include an element of spontaneity in online conversations that I think so far anyway, as far as I can see, people have found very challenging. I remember at the start of the pandemic, you know, there were services like quarantine chat, where you essentially were connected safely with somebody in another part of the world where you had a conversation with them to sort of learn more about how lockdown was going for them. And there are versions like that, but then sort of again, the people who sign up for those kind of things are probably people who are in a particular mindset or looking for a particular thing, and they might not be the people who are loneliest who we actually really want to reach.
So we can't have a conversation about communication without talking about the task facing governments across the UK in terms of communicating to the public through all of this. So how can governments communicate the complex and changing messages about different stages of lockdown easing, how these apply to different groups, in ways which give people confidence to change their social and economic behaviour? And how might this impact on tackling loneliness and social isolation?
Yeah, so I wish I had an easy answer here. I think part of the challenge of the last few months and the coming months is that the guidance at the start was very simple. It was stay at home, do not leave for any reason except in an emergency, which is, in terms of messaging from a behavioral insights perspective, relatively easy for all of us to follow, in the sense that we know what we're being asked to do. Whereas over the next couple of months and years, it's what we're all supposed to do is going to vary depending on where we live, how the individual risk that is posed to us from coronavirus and a whole host of other factors, which means that I think the communication becomes a much harder job and much more complex. At the Behavior Insights team, since March, we have been running online experiments because, as you can probably guess, it's been harder to do experiments in the real world when everybody's at home. So we've run essentially versions of the randomized controlled trials that I discussed earlier, but with an online panel of people. Now, there are a number of drawbacks to those that it's important to point out, first of all. So the first is that these are all people who are digitally skilled. So a lot of the people that we might be thinking about from a loneliness perspective are not going to be in our samples because they can't access the internet or this particular sort of service. And the second is that we're relying on what people say they will do rather than what people actually do. And as I mentioned earlier, we are not often very good predictors of our own behavior. So when I say that I think I'll react differently to something, or that I will definitely do something, then you obviously have to take it with a grain of salt. But I thought I'd reference one particular experiment that we ran in August, which looked at how is the way in which restaurants are framed to us, how does that affect our likelihood of visiting them? And so we essentially showed an online panel of people a different set of vignettes about a restaurant. So you either saw a restaurant server, or you saw a restaurant server with a mask, or you saw a restaurant server with a mask and sort of a COVID secure sign in their restaurant. And we asked people, firstly, how safe they felt the restaurant was, and then also how likely they were to go to that restaurant. And we were quite surprised, I think, to find quite a big difference in how safe people felt a restaurant were and how willing they were to visit, based on kind of the safety measures in place in the restaurant. So it ended up being about a 20 percentage point difference in whether people were willing to go or not. And I think that shows that kind of for the future, that when we're thinking about economic and social changes that will be coming up in the next few months, is that the way in which we frame and communicate to the people will matter a lot.
I think that sometimes loneliness is about doing things which are very, very focused on loneliness, but loneliness is also affected by a much bigger set of factors. And I think that in a way this illustrates that the quicker we get through this, the lower the level of infection, the more confident that people feel, the better they will be able to re-engage in their social life and therefore with knock-on effects for loneliness. I think that for services who are particularly focused on loneliness and particularly focused on the most vulnerable people, I think that they need support and understanding in how they can interpret the guidance that they're getting from government in how they can then run the sessions that they're running. So for example, whereas normally they might go and pick people up in a car and pack a driver and one in the front and two in the back, now they would only feel that only able to do that with one person, or they're getting kind of minibuses so that people can be a kind of, you have two people in a minibus or something. So it becomes more expensive to run services. And I think that it's really important that that is reflected in kind of short-term funding so that people can do the things that they need to do to get people together in a safe way. Because I think, as we've seen earlier, the most lonely people are getting lonelier in this period. So what we need to do is to try to do something to reverse that by making sure that people have got the support and the resources to be able to continue their services and bring people together, particularly as we go into winter, where it will become harder for people to kind of do things outside. And I think that if people are still quite isolated, I think that may be a really challenging time, and particularly if we can't do the things that we normally do to get through winter in the run up to Christmas, which is, I think, often mainly just a way of pretending that it's not quite as dark as it really is. If we can't do that, I think that could be a really very challenging time. And as I say, it's likely to be a really difficult time for the people who are already in a difficult place.
We're coming towards the end of our podcast, but before we finish, what is one key takeaway you'd like people to get from what we've discussed?
I think we are increasingly understanding the importance of loneliness, both as a thing, as being important in its own right, but also its effects on our broader mental well-being as well as our physical health. But I think that as we understand its importance, I think it's also important that we understand the psychology of loneliness, the way in which it can create a downward spiral, that it can make it harder for people to engage in social life. And I think that therefore, that's something which we can think about in our own lives. If we're lonely, we can recognise that we might be in that downward spiral, and we may want to try to think differently in our own way. But also, if we think about those around us, that if you're worried about someone, then you will need to be more kind of proactive and supportive to them. And then that could also then go into services. There's definitely a role for psychological services in relation to loneliness. But I think often it will be about existing things like social prescribing or groups where thinking consciously about how loneliness affects people psychologically and what can be very productively done about that, I think is a really kind of crucial way in which we can move the dial on this issue.
And I think for me, it's to be as humble as we can in terms of trying to understand and figure out what works, and sort of learning from what doesn't work as much as we learn from what works. And also, I suppose, reflecting on what Robin's been saying during the conversation, is that as we think about the next few months, and you know, we think about the economic impact of the pandemic and the health impact of the pandemic, but the social impact of how, as we're thinking about lifting different restrictions or changing different restrictions, is how do we enable people to sort of maintain as much as possible sort of healthy social lives, and the importance of that and its sort of impact on both the economic and health impacts of the pandemic as well. Is sort of they all seem quite intertwined to me, and very important as well.
Thank you. We've had a great discussion today. You can find more information about our work on loneliness in the description box. Thank you to Claire and Robin for joining me today, and thanks to you for listening.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Pep Talk. Don't forget to click the subscribe button and rate us on your favourite podcasting app. And I hope you'll join us again soon for another Pep Talk.